This podcast is brought to you by the Legarten Institute. I'm Sianne Hansen, Executive Director, and we hope you enjoy this conversation.
I'm Alana Putza, Senior Program Director at the Legarten Institute's Transitions Forum. The day after the new Burmese government was sworn in, I hosted a discussion with Richard Cockett, editor at The Economist and author of Blood, Dreams, and Gold, The Changing Face of Burma. I asked him to share his insights about the country's historical influences and what's next for Burma at this critical stage of transition. Here's what he had to say.
So what I wanted to do today in my allotted time, 15 minutes, was to just try and tell you a little bit about the theme of the book, the main theme of the book, and how that feeds in to understanding Burma today and Burma's immediate future. Because as many of you will probably know, we're gathered on a particularly significant day. It's the first full working day of the new government. The new president was actually officially started work yesterday. So in one sense, it's all change. And you could see this as the eventual triumph for struggle for democracy by Aung San Suu Kyi's National League for Democracy Party that started maybe back in 1988. So it's the end of a long road. But as I will explain today, the picture's not all quite as rosy as it may seem. I would argue that we're probably at the beginning of a new phase rather than at the final triumph for democracy or anything as hopeful as that. And the reason for that is what I explain in the book. Well, but basically, the book is an attempt to explain the pathologies of Burma. And it's basically an exploration of why the country has never worked as a country. Because it was, of course, as you'll know, a colonial colony of the British from 1826 gradually until 1948 when the new Burmese government took over. But from the moment of that new government taking power, the country lapsed into civil war pretty well instantaneously. In those days, the Communist Party of Burma was one of the main foes, but also the ethnic minorities, the Karen and the Kachin, who live on the peripheries of the country. And basically, ever since 1948, the country has been in a state of some degree of civil war, civil conflict, and those conflicts indeed continue to this day. The major civil war between the Burmese government and the Karen may be temporarily ceased, but there are now small little wars popping up in, say, Shan State, other parts of the country. And, of course, we also have the well-advertised problem of the Rohingya now, the Muslim minority in the far west of Burma in Rakhine State. So, basically, the book is an attempt to explain why this should be so. And so you can place the new government and its challenges and the mountain it has to climb in that context. Because my argument is that the new government is not on a mission to restore Burma to some status quo ante before the military despots took over. It's in 1962. Their task is much, much more demanding. It's to create a new country. And that is the magnitude of the challenge. So, Blood, Dreams and Gold. The title is taken from a poem by the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, Blood, Dreams and Gold. And he was temporarily the Chilean consul in Rangoon, colonial Rangoon, for a year in 1927. He seems to have spent most of his time chasing Burmese women who broke his heart. And the poem that he wrote, which contains this phrase, is essentially about chasing one of these Burmese women. But this is how he described colonial Rangoon, a city of blood, dreams, and gold. And in another phrase he used, he described Rangoon as the world at its zenith, the world at its zenith. And what he meant by that was that colonial Rangoon in the 1920s and 1930s was indeed, I would argue, the most one of the most sophisticated, probably the most cosmopolitan, the most wealthiest entrepot city in Asia, and some would argue in the world outside of Western Europe. And it drew in hundreds of thousands, millions of immigrants to make their fortune, to share in the wealth, and to create this sort of very thriving and prosperous society. Before 1940, before the Second World War, indeed, Burma was probably, it was certainly the most prosperous country in Southeast Asia, one of the most prosperous in Asia. So that's a measure of how far it's fallen. It is now officially the second poorest country in Asia after Nepal. And the Blood, Dreams and Gold, I think, is a very good description of what the wealth of colonial Burma was founded upon. The gold, of course, refers to its abundant natural resources. Burma became rich on resource extraction, basically in those days, teakwood, oil, now gas as well, and minerals. Nowadays, that's mainly jade, but rubies, diamonds, and much else. The dreams were for the dreams of a new sort of society, a new sort of civilization, and the dreams of poor immigrants becoming very rich, and many of them did. And the blood was all about the conflicts that those immigrants and the conflicts that those immigrants had with the indigenous Burmese. Indeed, so extraordinary was this society in Rangoon that an English academic, now entirely forgotten, called John Sydenham Furnival, J.S. Furnival, invented an entirely new phrase to describe this society, and that phrase, as he called it, he called Rangoon, was the plural society. That's where the phrase comes from. The plural society was invented by him in the 1940s, specifically to describe the society of Rangoon and also its counterpart in the colony of the Dutch East Indies, now Indonesia, of what is now Jakarta. And Furnival was a civil servant, an academic, and he was fascinated by what had been created in Rangoon. He was writing there in the 1930s and 40s when people had been coming there for about a century. It was by that time a majority Indian city. Because Burma had been joined to the Indian part of the British Empire, the borders had been dissolved, so hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of Indians came over, flocking in, and they basically ran the country in its administrative capacity, but they also formed the heart of the traders, the shopkeepers, etc. Hundreds of thousands of Chinese came in. But as well as that, there was a thriving Armenian community. There was a very important Jewish community. For 1 year, Yangon had a Jewish mayor in the early 20th century, and the trading port of Pantin, a very small port but important for rice exports, that had a Jewish mayor. There were significant Turkish populations, there was a German presence, later a Japanese presence, many of them spies, the Americans were there. So it drew in a fantastic array of people. And this is how Furnival described the plural society in 1948, to describe Rangoon. In Burma, as in Java, probably the first thing that strikes the visitor is the medley of peoples, Europeans, Chinese, Indian, and native. It is in this sense, strictest sense, a medley, for they do not combine. Each group holds by its own religion, its own culture and language, its own ideas and ways. As individuals, they meet, but only in the marketplace, in buying and selling. There is a plural society with different sections of the community living side by side, but separately within the same political unit. Even in the economic sphere, there is a division of labour along racial lines. Natives, Chinese, Indians and Europeans all have different functions, and within each major group, subsections have particular occupations. The plural society arises where economic forces are exempt from control by social will. So notice how he describes it. For Furnival, the plural society is not a melting pot, as we would use it here. And the plural of society means something, in fact, exactly opposite. It means that there are lots of peoples between their own religious and cultural heritage side by side, but not mixing except in the marketplace. But Furnival coined the term pejoratively. He meant it as a criticism of the colonial society, because he was a Fabian socialist. So he thought that the lack of the creation of social will, what we would call social cohesion, was the primary fault of colonial society. And his main criticism of it was that although all these millions of people had come in to the small area of downtown Yangon, and you can see it exactly as it was in Furnival's time today, because, of course, the place has been pickled in acid for 70 years by isolation from the rest of the world. So it's perfectly preserved. But his main criticism of it was that the creation of this plural society shoved out the indigenous Burmese. So it was the indigenous Burmese, the Burmans, who lost out, because it was they weren't traders, they were feudal agriculturalists, a warrior nation who would be defeated by the British, and they did not participate very much, hardly at all, in this thriving entrepôt that the British had created. So what was one person's gain was another person's loss. And this was very important for the future history of Burma, because basically the primary project of the generals, I will use the term generals to denote the military governments that came into power from the late 1950s, early 1960s onwards, their primary project was twofold. It was to get rid of the colonialists, get rid of the British, but they shared that with anti-colonial movements all around the world. But also, they wanted to eradicate the plural society. And they did this through a process of what we call a policy of Burmanization. And they began in 1962 to pass a series of laws which basically was to nationalize all foreign businesses, and therefore effectively driving out all the foreigners, or those foreigners all in, occupied in trade and commerce, out of the country. So about 500,000 Indians left at that point, probably 200,000 Chinese left at that point. All the Anglo-Burmese fled. I traced just 8 families left in Moulmein, which is the trading port where most of them came on in the east of the country. The Armenians left, the Jews left. We reckon there are now 8 Jews in total left in Yangon, etc., etc. But furthermore, this Burmanization policy was also directed against what they called the indigenous minorities, ethnic minorities, the Kachin, the Karen, the Chin, all those who lived on the periphery of the country. They benefited from the plural society. They were part of, they were staff of the British Army, the colonial era army. They served in the British administration, achieved indeed very high places in the British colonial administration, unlike the Burmese. So they were privileged by the British. Many of them converted to Christianity, mainly the Baptist faith, particularly amongst the Kachin and the Karen. So also, Burmanization was directed against them because they were seen as satraps, allies, collaborators of the hated colonial regime and the plural society. And that basically, I would argue, drove the politics of Burma from 1962 right up to a few years ago. And the result of this was twofold. The economy collapsed. Because basically the generals drove out of the country all those entrepreneurs, the merchantmen, the big merchants, the finance houses for foreign capital that had made the country. It was all nationalised. And very quickly, Burma sank down the league tables of GDP per head, prosperity, etc., to where it is today. Secondly, it basically created the civil wars that have characterised Burma ever since. The Kachin, the Karen, etc. Fought back, formed armed militias and fought with the Burmese army. Fighting Ratatouille goes on. And the other consequence really was that the minorities, the immigrants of the 19th century were excluded from the national life very, very rigorously. And one example of that was the Rohingya, many of whom came to Burma, to Rakhine State, during the British administration, and they were discriminated against and harassed by both the Burmese and the Rakhine in Rakhine State, who didn't want them in Rakhine State either. And that was going on not just in the past few years, but from the 1970s onwards. Famously, they've never been made citizens of Burma. So that's what the argument of the book, and it unpicks all the aspects of Burmanization about how this has affected the country, how it seeped into every aspect of the country. And that's where, and that's basically the country that the NLD is now inheriting. Now, that has several, I think, important consequences for the government that comes in. First of all, when you go to Burma, for me, the most important thing to realise about the NLD is it's a Burman party, and it is regarded as a Burman party within Burma itself. And by Burman, that is the majority ethnic race, the Burmans, who constitute about 60% of the population, and about 40% are the other indigenous ethnic minorities that live on the peripheries. I've already mentioned the Kachin, the Shan, the Karen, the Mon, and many others, and probably about 5 to 6 million Muslims as well, many of whom are not counted as citizens. That's one dynamic. So one question for the new government, really, there is a hope that Aung San Suu Kyi, because of her reputation for democracy, for human rights, etc., civil rights, might be the first person with the charisma, with the integrity, with the political capital to finally work out a political agreement whereby the majority Burmans in the centre can live at peace with the ethnic minorities on the peripheries, including the Rohingya, 1 million Rohingya in Rakhine State. Because unless that happens, Burma, as I say, will actually never be at peace or enjoy a great deal of prosperity. And that's partly because most of the resources, the mineral resources, the future wealth of the country lie in these conflict zones. So, for instance, jade, which is probably its most important mineral in terms of money, it's estimated, one international NGO estimated that off the books, jade mining produced $31 billion for Burma in 2014. But that's off the books, so that's just what the generals took. It didn't go through the treasury or anything. And just, you might be wondering, is that a big figure or a small figure? By contrast, the total amount of Burma's legal exports, i.e. official exports, is $11 billion. So the illegal dues from just one mineral, jade, is three times the amount of Burma's legal exports. So the question is can the new government come to some accommodation with the ethnic minorities? And on that also rests, can they extract or capture more of the wealth of the country that comes from those regions for the central exchequer, for the official economy, and from that will come taxation revenues, etc., etc. Because basically the new government has no money. Tax revenues in Burma, it's just 5% of GDP, which is hopelessly low. I mean, it's usually thought of, you know, that countries are doing pretty badly if that figure is at 10%, 11% or 12%. Myanmar has 5%. So unless you capture more of that existing wealth of the country, the wealth that has been flowing out illegally, illicitly, through the generals and their crony networks for decades, you won't have any money to start rebuilding the country. So we maybe discuss the prospects of that. I'm pretty gloomy myself, and that's partly because the NLD is not a very inclusive party, that they may be profess to be Democrats, and they may have a fig leaf of several ethnic minority people in the higher echelons of the party, but they do not dictate policy. and they have no record of standing up very well for minorities. And as you're probably all aware, Aung San Suu Kyi herself has not stepped up for the most persecuted of the recent minorities, for the Rohingya at all. Indeed, she hasn't been able to mention them even by name over the past 3 years, when they've been the subject of terrible ethnic cleansing, I would argue tantamount to genocide, in Rakhine State over the past 3 years. But on the other hand, there is a, as I describe in the book, the plural society of Furnival's imagination looks much better in hindsight than it did to Furnival. Furnival was a Fabian socialist, so he saw money making and commerce as basically a grubby business and something that ranked very low in his order of priorities of what people should be doing. I would flip it myself. And I would say it's when you go there, particularly to look at downtown Yangon, I see one of the most remarkably diverse, tolerant, religiously pluralistic societies in the world. I think it's only New York rivals downtown New York for the breadth of the peoples who live there. But I would say also it's an example for the whole world of a certain sort of tolerance. As well, if you go downtown Yangon, as it was laid out by the British in the 1850s, they were creating a new society, and all the communities that went there, they all got little plots of land for their temples, for their churches, for their synagogues, for their madrasas, for their mosques, and it's all still there, right next door to each other, and they all get along very, very well. I went to Yangon in 2010 when it was done under military rule, and I went there directly from the Middle East and Africa, and I'd had 6 years there of nothing but sectarian warfare, genocides, etc., you know it all. And then I went to downtown Yangon, and I found this, I could only describe it as a nirvana of tolerance. And that's because it had been divorced from the world's problems, the world's politics, the world's divisions, for 60, 70 years. It's the only place in the world, and I'm waiting for someone to gainsay me on this, where you can find a Sunni Muslim caretaker of a synagogue. And it's the only place in the world where you can find a Sunni mosque and a Shia mosque sharing the same divide, the same wall, living side by side, very happily together. And I assure you, I have prodded the denizens of these mosques, synagogues, and churches as to, you know, are you worried about, you know, that I ask for Muslim caretaker every time I meet him, are you worried about working for the Jews? And he generally does not understand the question. He says, my family has been working here for three generations. We all get on very well with the Samuels, who is the Jewish family who run the synagogue, and I run my tea shop at the synagogue, and the front of the synagogue is on the street are now lots of paint shops, and they are run by Muslims as well, Muslim Bengalis. And they clear up at the synagogue after the Hanukkah festivals, etc., and they sweep the forecourt, etc., and they think nothing of it. They're all neighbours together. And when I ask them, so what unites you? And they say, as Furnival described, we all meet in the marketplace. We trade together. We are all traders. And that's what binds them together. So I think it's one of the most remarkable societies in the world, and it's a sort of laboratory for what people can do, true pluralistic society, united in the marketplace, united by a trade, looking outwards rather than convulsed by all the divisions that normally obsess us. So I think within that, there's great hope for Burma. I think it's often politics that drives the divisions in Burma, the ethnic division, as it does all over the world. So at that point, I will stop on a sort of vaguely optimistic note.
To hear more podcasts from the Legatum Institute, please visit our iTunes channel or website at www.li.com.